Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. The sun is shining. It's beautiful outside. The 95 degrees weather has left us, at least for a while, and you're going to really enjoy hearing about this one. Practicing normal. What does that mean to be normal? Well, we're going to define that in many different ways in this book. The houses in Pine Estates are beautiful McMansions. Oh, that sounds cool. Filled with high-achieving parents, children on the fast track to top colleges, all of the comforts of modern living, and the best security systems money can buy. Well, is this a normal community? We're about to find out. You're going to meet the Turner family. You're going to meet Jenna and JT. And you're going to meet some other people. You're going to meet Kate, who's facing truth about her husband, her mother, and her father, and that she might have preferred not to face, like all of us do, but I'm not going to tell you anymore. I'm going to introduce Kara Sue Atcherberg, and she's going to tell you the rest. Good morning. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad that I got your book. So when creating the title for this novel, how would you define practicing normal, if there's ever a definition for the word normal?
Oh, that's tough. I think that everybody has a different definition of normal, and everyone's normal is drastically different. Mine's different than yours. And so the title kind of came out of that, the fact that all of these characters are trying to live what they think is normal, but they're not managing it. They're all just practicing.
As I think most people go through life practicing and trying to be normal, and you do the best you can, but then sometimes you don't. But this really, you know, gave me pause for thought. Like, am I? I don't know. Each character has a distinct and different personality. Each character is flawed, and each one has both strengths and weaknesses. So Everett is the father. How would you describe him, and why was his relationship with others in the family strained, controlled, and sometimes over the top? I wasn't crazy about this guy at first, seriously.
You know, readers absolutely hate him. That's kind of the first thing they tell me in a lot of these
movies. Oh, good.
No,
I'm alone.
So, but you know, I think Everett really wants to be a good guy. He has the best of intentions, but he's selfish and incredibly selfish, and he's really caught in that whole male ego trap. He's disappointed with the way his life's worked out because he was a police officer and he was cut from the police force because of his own actions. That's all kind of hazy, and he had high hopes for his children, and they don't pan out to be what he thought they would be. And his wife is very distracted by taking care of her kids, their kids, and her mother, and he's trapped in a job that's nowhere near as exciting as he thought it would be. So he's frustrated, and he wants to be able to take care of his family. He wants to be able to fix things, but there's a lot that he can't fix, like his son who has Asperger's. You can't just fix Asperger's, and Everett doesn't get that. So, and he doesn't know how to repair his relationship with his daughter or his mother-in-law, and so he seeks affirmation in other ways, one being for the mistress.
That's a lot of men do things like that are not nice. That's not bad. That's not good. And getting caught is even worse, and that moves your family. So Jenna reminds me of somebody I know, but I won't say who. That's rebellious, that has a good heart. She thinks school is the wrong place to be. Boy, does this remind me of someone. And sends a message to others to feel the same way, and yet she's smart. And so is Wells, the boy across the street. I love this kid. Who says that she is not challenged or that she just doesn't want to be bothered. What's her story? And I like Wells. He's a good influence on her, and he's a good character.
Thanks. I think Tana is, it's a combination. She's not being challenged, but I think the bigger piece is that she doesn't feel accepted at school, which I think so many adolescents feel that way. I mean, she is different, but we all are, but when you're a teenager, that feels bigger. And so she doesn't feel she fits in there. She's not a cookie cutter kid. And so school is a place where she feels judged for not being quote unquote normal. So I guess that's her issue with that.
Well, I know there are a lot of kids that feel that school is just a waste of time and it takes up more of their social life. And you know, that they can't
right.
do what, yeah, I know. I know it from people, yeah. And I try to explain to them that I'm an educator by profession, and I taught for 36 years in a tough school in the Bronx. And lucky for me that they realize that education is power, And the more power you have, the more choices you have when you get older. But a lot of them don't realize that. And JT has Asperger's. And that's an important issue that you bring into the novel, which really made him one of my other favorite characters. So why did you decide to bring him into the story? It's great that you let the readers know that he's smart and that the school wants to hold him back in some respects, yet he can remember so much more than the others. So how would you explain that and explain Asperger's spectrum and where JT falls into the spectrum? Because they don't realize how smart he is. And I know that they can get violent at times, but that's, like I said, my nephew has autism and a touch of that, and he's not violent or anything like that. And with the training that he got at Easter Seals, which is phenomenal, you would never know that he's autistic at all. So in the right place. So where does he fall on the scale, and why don't they realize that, you know, it's okay, he gets upset, and they don't know how to deal with it?
Right. Well, I was reading a statistic that 1 in 68 children in the United States has is somewhere on the spectrum. And JT's on the high end because Asperger's kids are the high end of the spectrum. And so they generally can be out and about more so than kids on the very, very lower end in terms of, you know, you don't necessarily know it until you really spend time with them. And I think that they are underrepresented in writing in general in a lot of books. And when you're talking about 1 in 68 kids, that's a lot of kids, that's a lot of families. And I was really curious because I don't know a child with Asperger's really, really well. I had a neighbor and I have a friend who has a son with Asperger's. And so I've always been curious about how does that play out on a day-to-day basis for a family. And so I did a ton of reading and really was trying to, because I wanted to get this right. I was so captivated by all of it. Our school district mainstreams all kids in the special ed programs. And I can't speak to whether that's good or bad, but I know it's been great, at least for them. I know it's been great for my kids because my kids have gotten to interact with these students and gotten, you know, and are more tolerant and more patient and understand how much they have to offer and how much they can learn from them. And so it was really important to me to bring this character in and to do it right. And so when I had finished the first draft that I felt was like ready for other eyes, I did ask two parents and one grandmother of people who had a boy the same age as JT with Asperger's. I asked them to read the script and to let me know if there was anything that didn't ring true. And so that was really helpful in being sure that I got it right. Because it is important that we get to know these kids and that we realize how much they have to offer and we don't just marginalize them because they make us feel awkward. Because they don't feel awkward. They're not affected by their awkward socialness. We are, but they're not. I mean, they're just doing their thing, and there's a blessing in that, I guess. And JT just stole my heart, and I loved writing him. I loved writing about him, and he's a character I may someday come back to.
I really liked him, too. You know, as an educator, a lot of teachers and a lot of students and a lot of even administrators stereotype them, and that's wrong. And a lot of teachers don't know how to handle them. So if they're mainstream into a regular ed class, not a special ed class, which a lot of them are. My nephew's in a regular class where the teacher's aid in first grade. A lot of teachers aren't trained to handle students with Asperger's. And they assume it's something else. So the fact that you read up on it, you know, you got it right. Because I looked things up, too. When somebody does something based on research, I look up the research just to remind myself that did the person get it right. So what does Everett think and not understand that this is the Asperger's that is doing it to him and he feels that his son needs discipline? He's very hard on him. Why is that?
Everett doesn't understand him. He wants to fix JT, and he refuses to accept this because so much of what JT does is normal, just like so much of kids with Asperger's. Like I said, they can appear completely normal, but their brain's not wired the same way, I guess. I'm not really sure the whole technical reasons of why they, but he doesn't accept that, and so he sees him being so bright and so smart, smarter than him probably, and so he just thinks if he could just, you know, get over it. Why, you know, he doesn't understand why he gets so upset. I also think, to a certain extent, he's jealous of the attention and the allowances that Kate and Jenna make for him, for JT. And so he gets, again, frustrated that he's helpless in this situation. And I guess it's, again, his fault, though. He hasn't taken the time to understand the condition.
He's almost like a little kid that needs attention because everybody else is getting it except him.
Yeah.
Which is like,
I know guys like that.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, I know a whole lot of people like that. It's scary. They need to remind themselves that they have responsibility and adults and not little kids and look at me all the time. There are a lot of grown-ups, a lot of kids like that, a lot of people. So Kate is the mother. And I felt sorry for her at times. And I wanted to pour some cold water on her and say, wake up. Kate is the mother who often sounds overwhelmed. Yeah, I mean, like, why just too much? And cannot deal with all the stress and confrontations with a lot of people. She has to take care of her mother, which is not easy. And then Jenna and her attitude and breaking and entering quantity. And then JT is in need for structure. How does she separate this and, you know, decompartmentalize them? I mean, she seems like when, at times she wants to sit down in the middle of the floor and scream and cry. So how does she deal with that?
Right. She is very overwhelmed. I think she just keeps going. She has this vision of having this family and having this normal life. It's what she wants for her kids. And so it's like she, all these little fires come up and she's just constantly putting them out and dealing with them. So she's trying to juggle so many balls all the time, taking care of her mother and making sure JT's routines stay in place and also being his advocate at school. And then still trying to have some kind of relationship with her daughter. And in the midst of all of that, her sister is meddling in their life and trying to bring her father back into it. And she does know that Everett's not being honest, but she wants him to be a good man. She wants him to be better. And so she can't deal with that. She can't. That's really a big thing that's going to affect everything. So she glosses over it and just keeps going, keeps trying to make things normal, keep things normal so that they can keep going.
Well, normal in her eyes, but not normal in anybody else's eyes, maybe.
Yeah.
So why does it appear at times that, at times, like I said, I want to, you know, yell at her and say, wake up. You've got so much to offer. Why does it appear at times that she just ignores some of the behavior and doesn't stand up for herself? She realizes that her husband is distant. I really don't like this guy. And doesn't come on when, you know, doesn't come on when he is supposed to. And he's cheated on her before, and that's not good. I would have told him to take a hike a long time ago. So why does she discount it and justify his behaviors when in her heart she knows that he's wrong? Why does she think, it's almost like, I deserve this because I'm not paying attention to him, so someone else is. Why doesn't she wake up and say goodbye or stand up for herself?
I think she's fought really hard for this marriage from the very beginning. And and the first time that he's caught cheating, you know, they go to therapy and she takes it really seriously. He obviously doesn't, but she really dives in and wants to make this right. And Everett, you know, he was her knight in shining armor who rescued her from this lonely life living with her very bitter mother. And her mother told her at the time, like, it's going to fail. All men are horrible. And she doesn't want her mother to be right. She doesn't want to go back to that. She is just trying to keep it going. And probably she knows where it's headed because she's not a stupid woman. But at the point right now, her kids are more important. Her mother is more important than she is to herself. So she focuses on them and she just keeps going until literally her life is in danger.
She's like a never-ready battery that's waiting to wear out, sort of. And it's time to recharge. So why does she have to take care of her mother? What is with her mother?
Her mother is older. She's not super old, but she's older and she lives down the street and she has had some she's had some mental issues all along, I would say, to a certain extent, just that she's lived a very isolated life. And now she's really needy. She's had broken her hip and that didn't heal so great. And she ended up becoming more and more dependent on her daughter and her daughter being there for her. And Kate feels responsible for it because she has no one else in her life. Her younger sister, Evelyn, has this kind of jumped ship, not really jumped ship, but doesn't really want to have much to do with her mother. And her husband won't speak to her mother. And so her mother only has her, and she's become more and more dependent on her. And Kate's just this caretaker, and she's sort of trapped in that relationship. And her mother lets herself become more and more dependent on Kate.
Well, I know how that feels because I spent 11 years taking care of my mother, and it makes it hard. Let me tell you. So there are times that you wonder, what is normal? Am I ever going to get to go outside and do something other than take care of a parent? And my, like I said, my mom had Alzheimer's, and it makes it really hard, you know, at times. But you know what? You just, like her, you just keep going like an ever-ready battery, and you do what you think you need to be done. And I make a bet if Kate had to do it again, she probably would do it the same way. Because
probably.
Somehow promises are made, yeah. Jenna is smart. And told him if he dares to send her, I love this. This was my favorite spot in the book. This was so fantastic because she stood up to her father. I go, yeah, finally, because that would be me. Jenna is smart and told him if he dares to send her for juvie, he will pay. Why did you include that in this story? And what was their relationship when he was the cop, and how did this aid in his ability to pick locks? She's good at picking locks, Jenna. Jenna. She's really cool,
she
let me tell you. Cool character.
I love Jenna, too. She, you know, Jenna worshipped her father growing up. She just thought,
yeah.
You know, he was awesome when he was a police officer. And then when he began working at a security company, she tagged along and followed him everywhere like a shadow. And one of the things he did was to go into houses and show people how easy it was to break into their house and then sell them a security system. So she saw him being a smart kid. She picked up on all of that over and over, and she understood that. And so that's how she learned to pick locks. But when she had that confrontation with her father and he threatened to send her to juvie, she sort of made it known that she, you know, she's not going to back down. She's not this little kid that followed him around worshiping him anymore. She doesn't worship him anymore, and she's angry. I mean, she's hurt, and she's angry. She's so angry at him and disappointed in him, and that kind of drives a lot of her behavior, and it's a big one, you know, when you idolize somebody so much, especially a parent, and then you suddenly realize they're human, and not just human, but really a bad human, kind of, you know, that's heartbreaking, and for a kid, it's devastating, and I think that's the moment when she kind of makes it clear to him, you know, I'm done, you're going to have to fix this, because I'm done.
I would tell you, she's a spunky kid. And basically, deep down, you know that she's not such a horrible person, but she's got her reasons. And she so reminds me of somebody I know. Never mind. JT is so smart. This really got me incensed. As an educator, the one thing that you never do is hold back a student. And if a student belongs in a better place, in a higher class, then you put him there or her there. And JT is so smart that he's going to go to for pre-calculus. Why not other subjects? And he had trouble with socialization. So they didn't think that he would be able to do it. So how come you included that? I thought that was really good to show people that this type of student is really smart and probably smarter than the ones in the class in general.
Right. Because just like you said, they are so bright, and we hold them back based on social issues, and that's not fair, because you don't know what they're capable of doing until you find out. And there's a math specialist in this book who is actually based on a person I know, and I don't generally do that, because she's advocating for him. She's like, we won't know what these kids can learn until we give them the opportunity. And I feel like we hold kids back, kids with Asperger's certainly, and just ordinary kids too, because we think, you know, because they're immature or because they, you know, don't talk to adults the way adults want to be talked to, or whatever it is. We don't let them expand and go further and see how much they can learn and what they're capable of doing. And we won't do it unless you know we allow them to. They're never going to be able to do that. So pushing for that, that was kind of a statement to a certain extent. But it was also a chance for Everett to step up, and he does. And show a little good, because he's not all awful. It's like there's no person who's all awful. They're always, you know, we're all complicated. We're all a blend, and there's something good, I believe, in everyone, even the most horrific person. And so Everett is given this tiny little moment to shine and to do what's right and to help his kid. And so there was a lot going on in that scene and a lot that was important to the novel for that to happen. But he doesn't go into other subjects, and just the calculus, because math is something that's very clearly black and white, very concrete. And so a student like like JT is going to excel in that, whereas in other topics like English or social studies where they might have to, he might have to interpret literature in context with today's society, that's going to be a bigger challenge for a kid with Asperger's. But you don't hold him back in math just because he can't go forward in, you know, English or social studies or whatever else. And so that was kind of what was happening there. And I loved how that came about. And it definitely wasn't in the original plan. It just sort of one of those scenes that kind of evolved.
Well, it makes sense because I have to tell you, my nephew, he's learning to read, but the area that he does excel in is math. And they do excel in math because it's more of a concrete kind of thing where they could actually see the numbers and visualize it more than sometimes they could visualize the meaning of words. So this is important. And socialization issues, unless they have interaction with other kids that are not like them or are like them, they're going to have a problem getting along, which is really great that you brought that out too. So when we get to know Jenna, we meet Cassie, another one I like, her neighbor. Why was she able to bond with her and not her mother at times? And tell us about Cassie, because I liked her too.
Cassie is another favorite of mine too. Well, Cassie is Jenna's neighbor, and she's so non-judgmental. That's the person that she is, and part of that is perhaps because she doesn't have kids. She is a single woman in her 40s who is also a hospice nurse, and she's well aware that Jenna's been breaking into her house, but Jenna breaks into her house just to feed her cats because Cassie has 7 cats. And and so when Cassie doesn't come down, like when they interact, she treats Jenna with respect, even though she's aware of that. I think that means a lot to Jenna. So she becomes somebody that she can relate to and talk to and feel safe around, but she's also really curious about Cassie. Here's this person living this different life. She's not, you know, she's not like everybody else, and she's single, and she has all these cats, and she's a hospice nurse, which to Jenna is crazy. Why would you have a job where you know the ultimate, you know, ultimately your patient's going to die, and then that's the goal, so to speak. And so she found a really great friend in Cassie, and Cassie ended up being very key in all of that. I totally adored her. I spent a lot of time learning about hospice because I've never met a hospice nurse, and so I read multiple books and blogs, and I went and I actually read this one book that was first person, and it was written by a hospice nurse, and she was such an interesting person. She told these stories very matter-of-factly, but you could also tell how much compassion she had. And she shared a lot of the nitty-gritty and a lot of the pain, but also the beauty of being hospice and what it can do for a family. She was another person when I had the manuscript kind of cleaned up and ready to go, I contacted her, and she was very, very gracious. And she read the manuscript too and was really helpful, definitely pointed out some things that were like, no, you know, and that helped me too, because like JT, Cassie was a character I wanted to get right. I wanted to do well.
Your caregivers are very special. I had caregivers too, but fortunately they need a hospice nurse, but just about the same thing. And these people, you know, they have to understand that what they're doing is so special, and the people that they're working with have to really appreciate the fact that they're doing something you could never do. And that's something that, you know, came through in the book. So it's Mildred. She's a character. And I know she wanted attention, but she kept saying, I'm going to be dead. The end is near. So what happens when she accidentally sets the house on fire? And you would think that she did it on purpose, but I'm not sure she really did it on purpose. Or did she?
No, she didn't. And the house,
I didn't think
so. The accidental fire was definitely an accident, but it was also a wake-up call. It made Kate's sister Evelyn, Mildred's other daughter, become even more more militant about getting her in a home, getting her, you know, doing something about mother.
Yeah.
You know, there's something wrong here, and we have to fix this, because she's another go-getter. But it also made Kate more protective of her, and feeling like she was even more, you know, Mildred was even more dependent on her, because now she can't operate her stove. Now she can't be trusted with the stove because of this accident. And so Kate's there even more looking for and taking care of her. And But it really makes Kate realize, I think, this is the time of, like, her mother being in the hospital and Kate being back in the hospital, because Kate was an ER nurse and it was a time in her life when she was really happy. So being in the hospital with her mother and seeing all that starts to awaken some of that for her, like, make her realize how much she missed it. So it does. It's another moment in the novel where things start to turn a different direction.
That's true, because a lot of family, I know I kept my mom home, my promise that I wouldn't put her in a nursing home, and yet there are friends and family that thought I was absolutely out of my mind for doing something like that. And the expense alone at first is exorbitant, but you have to decide,
right,
if you're going to be a caregiver, that, you know, you're going to donate your time and your energy, and you have to decide eventually if that's something that you can continue to do. So let's bring in Frank. Why does Evelyn want to contact him? Oh, boy, did I want to yell at her. And they had a reason for not wanting to talk to him. So why did they contact him? And why does she want to talk to him, but nobody else does? How come? They want him to just stay away and go and disappear like the wind.
Well, Evelyn's a strong person, and she's one of those people who, like, doesn't have enough going on in her own life, so they have to create more drama, I suppose. But she's always been curious about her father. She's a lawyer. She's a person who's very intelligent and wants to have the answers to all of the questions. And so that's always been a question, because Mildred has always said that Frank cheated on her and left them. And that's been the story, and that's her reason for saying men are horrible and they'll all cheat and leave. And that's the storyline of these girls that Kate and Evelyn grew up on. And so Evelyn has never been satisfied with that answer. She has memories that she's probably created in her own mind, because she was pretty young when he left, but she won't let it go. And so she's been trying to find him, and she has the resources now to do it. And she actually does manage to track him down. But Mildred doesn't want him to come back, because if Frank comes back, then everybody finds out what really happened, and they know what the real story is. And that, for her, is hard in a lot of ways, because she had an incredibly passionate relationship with Frank. She absolutely loved him. Not that she would ever have admitted that, but him coming back is going to do a lot of things. One, it's going to show her what she gave up all of her life. Another, her daughters are going to find out the truth of their birth, which is not a pretty truth. And there's also the chance that he's going to take her daughters away, that they're going to be angry at her, and that she's going to lose them. Mm. So Frank coming back could destroy her in a million ways. So she's adamantly against it. Kate's against it simply because it's stressing her mother. It's creating more tension there, and she doesn't want to see her mother stressed. She's also against it because, like, she's having enough trouble dealing with all of what's going on in her life. So she doesn't need just one more person, because for her, every family member is making a demand of her, and she doesn't need another one. So she's against it. And then Everett's just against it because he's against everything at that point, at least his family, Mildred and all of it.
Well, he's not against Veronica.
No, he's not.
Yes, I know. I realized right away. So why does he justify his actions? In his own mind, Veronica is like whatever, she's just there. And even though he has a great wife and two kids that are really not very horrible, why does he cheat on her? And what is he justifying in his own mind that, you know, she texts him and then he just runs like a little puppy dog?
You know, every time he visits her, he regrets it the moment he leaves. But for whatever reason, he can't resist her. Now, whether that's just the male thing, and Jen has a few thoughts on that. Mm-hmm. I think he needs an affirmation, though. I think we all do. And maybe men need it more than women, I don't know. But we all do. And he's not getting it anywhere. And he's not happy at work. His wife is distracted and suspicious. And his daughter, who used to be, you know, his pride and joy because she was so bright and she worshipped him, well, now she can't stand him. And his son taxing himself. So he's not getting affirmation anywhere. And I think that's what he gets from Veronica is that. And so she's the one, I don't know, it's not good, but the one good thing in his life, to his mind at this point.
Well, what about Wells and Jenna? How do they connect? And why doesn't his parents or sister, why don't they, Tiffany, why don't they like Jenna? I mean, I like Jenna. She's different. So why do they not like her?
Well, Wells comes from a very privileged life. They have like the nicest home in the neighborhood, and they have a lot of money, and his father went to Harvard, and he's so Jenna's always made assumptions about that whole family based on that, on the cars they drive, the way their, you know, house looks, the fact that his sister is, you know, and he are the in crowd at school. He's a football star. He's all of that. And so they're very different. And so even though they've lived across the street from each other and they've known each other, they've never really known each other. But then Wells is cut from the football team, and so because of his grades. And so he's around. And Jenna gets caught breaking into their house. And so that gets his attention. And so he's curious about this goth girl across the street who broke into his parents' house. And so suddenly he's got time on his hands and he's curious. And so that's sort of how that happens. And in the beginning, Jenna's very suspicious of him, but then eventually, you know, they find out that they are just, you know, that they can be friends and that they both have been making a lot of assumptions about each other. So they break some stereotypes there. And his parents and sister don't like her. Well, the parents don't like her because she broke into their house, and his sister doesn't like her because she's not in the in crowd, and his sister is very much in the in crowd, and so she kind of looks down her nose at Jenna and doesn't understand why her brother
like
is spending all his time with her. Yeah.
Well, he's more down to earth, and she's a snob, and I don't like people that are snobs. And, yeah, you do, you stereotype people according to race and color and a whole bunch of stuff. And that gets me. I don't like that at all. So that's what made this even better for teens to read this, seriously, because they can get an idea of what not to be and how to react, and how to react to other people that are different. So what are the signs that we know that Jenna is really a good heart, has a good heart? I figured she'd eventually turn around. And when did she decide to realize that she wants to reconnect with her mother and maybe develop a better relationship?
Jenna does have a good heart, and I think it's obvious in the way that she loves her brother fiercely, and also in the way she relates to the animals that she encounters, the cats and her dog Marco, and you see this really kind heart, despite the way she looks and the way she talks. She is angry with her father, but more than anything, she's really hurt by his actions. So I think that affects her too, and also says something to the reader. I think people can get that when they get to know her. She and Kate, I think they really begin connecting when Jenna starts dating Wells, and Kate finds out because it's a love story, it's a romantic, and so it's for her. They're starting to connect, and also when Jenna starts taking care of Cassie's cats, like legally, not illegally, and then when JT starts going to the high school. So all these things are starting to happen, and Kate's beginning to need Jenna and to look at Jenna with different eyes. She's not this little girl. She's this person who can help protect JT, and she's this young adult who's made a relationship with someone that her mother doesn't even know and now is, you know, taking care of the cats. And then the love story, I think, too. I think Kate doesn't have anyone to tell about this, really. And so she and her mother start to relate less as, you know, little kid and mom, and have this better relationship where they both have something to offer each other, and there's a respect going both ways.
Well, before I forget, on Tuesday, 6:20, Amber Brock will be here with a fine imitation. On the 22nd, this is Holocaust Survivor Choices. It's about a true story about how this woman escaped and how she went to freedom. And she is a true Holocaust survivor, J.F. Leifer. And I am really, really honored that she is willing to to talk with me about her book. And on the 29th, you have to listen to this woman because you're not going to believe it. The title of the story is Penny. And it's about the last penny that was ever made and minted with copper, 97 point something percent of copper, on October 22, 1982, and our very famous Penny tells the story of his journey and how he goes from place to place, and I won't tell you where he winds up. But this author wrote this book just when I needed it. It's hilarious. And the stories are funny, and he agreed to be on the show, and that's Peter Davidson on the 29th. And then I take the month of July off, everyone, and I start back on August 1st with a really good mystery that Cheryl sent me, 66 Metro, with the author from France, in which you read about Nadia, in which you read about that one. So what is your definition of a dysfunctional family? Because would you consider this family dysfunctional, or are they trying to become, like, unified?
No, I would say they're pretty dysfunctional.
Okay.
I guess a dysfunctional family is a family that can't communicate, and a family that don't know how to express love and support for each other, a family that doesn't know how to be a family.
Mm. That is so true. And this family, well, has a lot of lessons to go. So tell us about Laura and Cassie. I like that one. And she suggested that she assesses Mildred. Was that a good thing or a bad thing?
So Laura is a friend of Cassie's who is a doctor, and she sees a lot of geriatric patients, and she's a very good friend of Cassie. So Cassie, as she gets to know Mildred because of Jenna, is worried about her, and she, being a nurse, sees some, and not being related to Mildred, sees stuff that the family doesn't necessarily see. So she asks if it would be okay for Laura to pay a visit with Mildred. Mildred won't leave the house, especially now after the fire. She's even more so, like, only staying home.
Hello? What happened? She dropped out. How did that happen? Shell, she dropped out. I don't know why she disconnected. She's going to have to call back in. I hope she calls back in. I don't know what just happened that called out. It's not on my end. I have no idea. Hi, Cheryl. It's Fran. I don't know what just happened that she dropped out. I hope she calls back in again. Can you hear me? Cheryl? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
I don't know why she's not calling back in. I'm going to try, and unfortunately, I don't know if I can, I'm going to try to call her, but with Blog Talk, I don't know. If you can email her, tell her to call back in, because I have a ton more questions to ask, and I don't know what just happened. That never happened before. I'm going to see if I can dial her number, if I could see it. Okay, let me see if I could do this on my computer myself and then get her. 717227. I don't know if she was on a cell phone. Oh, she's there. Okay.
Hi, I
don't know what happened just now. I have no idea what happened just now, but I'm glad you're back. So I was trying to call you in with this with Blog Talk. I never know. Are you on a cell phone?
I'm not. I'm on my home phone.
I don't know. That happens sometimes. I don't know why. So there are secrets that are revealed at the end that are so tragic and sad. Why did you decide to reveal them to Evelyn and Jenna, whose relationship was not exactly the closest to start with? How did you decide on that? And did you want the aunt and the niece to sort of develop a relationship?
So at the end, when it was all revealed, I think they were the people who had a lot of questions, and you don't see a lot of their relationship all the way through. So at the very end, when I don't want to give away secrets in case
No, don't give it away.
Evelyn especially, she's kind of a negative through the book, but again, like I've said before, I feel like everybody has good and bad in them, and there is good, and it's she needed to hear it. She needed to hear what the truth was there, and Jenna also got a chance to see her mother and her aunt and her grandfather in a different light, you know, to know the truth and to be treated like an adult in that situation was good. Does that answer?
Well, I'm hoping. Yeah, that does answer. I'm not saying, you know, it's funny. I just got an email from Autism Speaks, which is one of the sites that I belong to do research. Yeah, to do research on. So, what happens when? What about Frank? Tell us about him, and why would he? Why did, I'm not going to ask the question that's on my paper, but why did? What did they? What it happens when he comes back? I'm not going to say why or anything about him, but. What happens when they see him? How do they react? I know what I would do.
Well, Kate's kind of there under duress because she has to be there. Evelyn really wants their relationship to be this. She wants it to be a happy ending. She wants her mother to be wrong. She wants everything to, you know, to be explained, and she wants to have this relationship. She wants to have a father, and she well, Mildred. Mildred obviously reacts very dramatically to the fact that he's coming back and is there. But Evelyn's sort of watching over the whole thing. Like, he's going to come back and this is going to solve everything, and we're going to be this nice, happy family now because now Dad's back. And the reader doesn't get to know a lot about Frank, but I don't know that they necessarily need to. I think there was a lot. I wrote a lot about him that actually never made it into the whole story, and he's a misguided, misunderstood man who acted in what he believed was like a loving way that turned out to backfire and hugely and destroy lives, really.
Well, he's not the nicest character in the world. So, if Jenna could speak for her family, what would she say about them, and why would she not have a solid relationship with her father? Or will she ever have a solid relationship with her father?
Well, Jenna, she loves her family fiercely. I mean, she really does, despite all. I mean, she, you know, at one point in time, her family was wonderful, right? She adored her father. Mm-hmm. She had this little brother, and, you know, there was never a major issue with her mom. And it's that love, it's that, like, love that she used to have that drives her anger towards Everett, because he's disappointed her on such a grand scale. And she loves her mother, but she's mad at her mother, too, because her mother doesn't appear to see her father's behavior, and she does. So she's, from what she can see, her mother is choosing, I guess her mother is choosing to ignore her father's behavior, but that makes her angry that her mom's not reacting, because she should, in her mind.
Well, there's one more character that I didn't write a question to, but it's up to you if you want to tell us. How did she meet Phil? How did Kate meet Phil? I like this guy. That's all I'm going to say about him.
Phil's probably the closest to normal. So Phil is another neighbor, and he met Cassie because his wife was dying of cancer, and Cassie was their hospice nurse. And so he moves into the neighborhood. And so they originally, Kate meets him at the neighborhood chili cook-off that happens at Wells' house, and that's where they initially meet. And then they just encounter each other again and again throughout the rest of the novel.
Okay, we're not going to say any more about them. So before we end, Father's Day is Sunday, and Amazon delivers the next day. And you could get a whole bunch of copies of Practicing Normal for your family. That's my favorite present. So, you know, I don't have to buy books anymore. This is so much easier. People just send them to me. And I never know what I'm getting. And I got all excited because D.P. Lyle, the guy that writes for CSI and Criminal Minds and stuff, they just sent me his book. And I'm going like, oh, my God, this is so fantastic. And he's going to interview with me in December. So you never know what's going to appear in my mailbox. if JT could speak to readers, what do you think he would want for his major goals, and what are many areas he'd like to research? If he could choose his next plot line, what would it be?
Well, JT's really curious, and who knows why he moves from one thing to the next. And he does, at the end, start to become really fascinated with neuroscience and the brain and why is the brain, and you don't know whether that's because of whether he's really aware of what happened with his grandmother, or not. But he really immerses himself in things, and I think that's an Aspergian thing to do. And he really wants to understand all of it. And so that's where he is. And I don't know where he's going to go, but, you know, he has a mind that could do just about anything in terms of, like, research. And I think probably, you know, and I definitely don't have any statistics on this, but I bet a lot of scientists fall somewhere on the spectrum, a lot of the, you know, really, really big scientists, because they have these, incredible minds.
I think he can be anything he wants to be if he sets his mind to it. And, you know, people really have to understand that, yeah, it may take them a little bit longer, but yes, they can. So if Everett could change and speak for himself, how would he justify himself, or what would he do? Would he want to change, or is he always going to be himself?
I don't know if he's capable of it. I want to hope that he is capable of change. And I think he does want to be that guy. He wants to be that good guy that Kate fell in love with, but he can't. And, whether he can change or not, maybe he can, and I want to hope that he can, but it might be too late for salvaging his relationship with his family.
That's too bad. Well, you know what? Kate stands tall at the end, and I got up and cheered. Finally. We won't say why. So if you continued this novel, where would you see her next? Would she go back to nursing? Would she do something else? Where would you see her next? Her next goal or her next chapter in life? If you wrote one more chapter about her, what would you write?
I think she's going to take her time. I think she's going to reinvent her life. But I think it's still going to revolve around her children. I think JT and Jenna are going to continue to be the focus because that's the kind of person she is. I'm not sure she'll get into a romantic relationship again or anytime soon. I think she's going to spend some time rediscovering who she is without her mother hanging over her or ever controlling what she's doing. And, I could see her definitely going back to nursing because she's a caregiver. And what kind of nursing, I don't know.
Well, she might actually try something similar to what Laura did. Maybe she'd want to be – hospice is hard. You have to have a strong constitution to know that the person that you're taking care of is not going to be around very long. And that's hard.
Right.
And no matter what kind of caregiver you are, like I said, I had 6 home health aides when I finally got the right ones. And every day of my mother's life that they were with me, I blessed them and bought them breakfast and lunch and took care of them as if they were my sisters or mothers or whatever. So for those people out there that are caregivers, you know that you're doing something that no one else could do and realize that you're very special, even if no one tells you. So if you continue this novel, would you bring back Jenna and Wells? Are they going to develop more of a interrelationship, even though he's going to school?
I think Wells and Jenna will remain friends because I think that friendship is strong underneath everything else. I don't know if they'll stay together because we all change so much from that age. And so much of their early attraction was probably the secretness, you know, the novelty of that relationship. And that's exciting, the whole secret. But as the novel, Cassie points out many times that grinding out real love is work. And whether they're mature enough to do that, I don't know. They're too young now to understand that. But I think Jenna's definitely seen enough that she's not going to go willingly or blindly into a relationship. So it's hard to say. It depends on how they change in the next 10 years.
Well, do you think she'll ever think school is worth it? I mean, she reminds me of
somebody
I know.
Yeah, I think she'll love college.
College is different. High school was not I was an A student, and high school was not my favorite place because I didn't feel that, I don't know why, the teachers were not like myself when I taught, and they really were just there to just give you work to do and didn't really get up and teach anything. Whereas in college, it's a whole other life, and you have to really grow up because no one's going to tell you to do your homework. You just have to do it, and if it's not handed in, just, you know, take the F and whatever, or withdraw. So this book brings to light the issues of acceptance, tolerance, understanding, stereotyping, and a whole lot. How do these issues come to play throughout the entire novel, especially acceptance and understanding of other people?
Well, we judge each other, and we make so many assumptions about people without having the first idea of what's really going on in their lives. And I think that's kind of the underlying, or where I started when I had the idea for this novel. I think the novel makes a case for accepting people where they are and for being honest about who we are and what we want. I think that's the message in there. We need to not be so busy keeping up appearances that we don't do the hard work of loving people. And we need to accept people that we love, especially. That's kind of, sometimes they're the hardest ones to accept because they're so close.
Well, the one thing I said before we started the show was you decided to write the chapters from the point of view of each character. Why did you decide to do that? Because it made it easier for me to understand the characters and get to know them. How come you picked that particular mode of writing?
I tried not to. I wanted to write it in third person. but there was so much that was happening inside each person, and they each had their own explanations. And then I guess the whole point of the novel was that we make these assumptions about people without knowing them. So you can't know these characters unless you hear from them directly, unless you're in, you know, you're sitting on their shoulder, you're in their head, you're getting their point of view. Otherwise, you know, you can't know them. Otherwise, you're going to be making assumptions and judgments too, you know, as the narrator. So, you know, going into their heads and letting them speak. And originally it was just going to be Jenna and Kate. And in the beginning of the book, it is just Jenna and Kate. And then Everett just so clearly was trying to speak. And I kept hearing him. Like, I could almost imitate him, but you could hear him. And so I finally let him speak. So then he did get to put in his two cents here and there. Not as much as the other two, though.
No, it made it more real. It made it more realistic for me to get to know them. So before I ask you the normal question, which I asked at the end, is what's next and where can we find out about you, how would you say the titles Practicing Normal change from the beginning of the story to the end? Is this family ever going to be normal, or do they stay the same? Or do you think maybe they develop a different definition of the word practicing normal?
Yeah, I think that's just it. I think they have to find a new normal, and they have to each find their own new normal, and it's definitely going to be different. And I think they're going to, at least for Kate, they're going to start trying to define their own normal and not try to have the normal that, you know, is in the romance novel, is in the nice neighborhood. It's going to be a normal that's their normal.
That is true. And each of the point of views, and Cheryl agrees with me, you should have written more chapters. We both agree. And so what is next for you? And where can we find out about your work, and when am I getting it? I don't normally say when am I getting it, except if I really think the author's books are great, though, then I say when am I getting it.
Well, right now my agent's currently shopping a memoir that I wrote about my family and our first 50 foster dogs. We foster dogs for a nonprofit rescue, and so that's what the memoir is about. And so she's currently shopping that, trying to find a home for it, but it hasn't found one yet. And then we're also putting final edits on a new novel, which I don't know when that one will come out, but it's getting really close to being polished. And you can find
you
out more about those. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, are you going to use Story Plant again?
I don't know that yet.
Okay.
Possibly. There are links to all my blogs and my other two books that I did with Story Plant on my website, KaraWrites.com. It cares with a C.
Well, I hope you write another mystery or a murder mystery or something, because this is really a good one. And the fact that you picked a topic like Asperger's and it, you know, elaborated it within the novel and made it real, because there's so many dysfunctional people in the world, that I think that this would be great for schools, for guidance counselors, and kids in group discussions to learn more about teens and what not to do and how to react. This would really be great for you to go in to talk to high schools. This is my teacher part of me coming out, thinking that teenagers would be great to discuss books like this. This is a great research. And for people that don't understand Asperger's, this is a great way to meet JT and understand that he's just like everybody else, except probably more intelligent than most people, and can probably show you a few things or two. So I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. This was really great, and I really hope that when you write your memoir that I get to read it, because I do read those, and I do review those. Like I said, the only type of books I really am not crazy about is self-help, and I will not read anything that's erotica or porn. So when they sent me the most famous title, and they did send me all three of them, I sent it back, and I didn't read it. That's the first time I said no. And probably, hopefully, it'll be the last. Thank you so much. And I am going to change the promo right now because I don't know why this didn't come out right, but I will fix to practicing normal so that everybody could read it and I'm hear it. And I'm going to turn the show to public so that everybody could hear it because the show is monitored and recorded by Blog Talk Radio to make sure that there is nothing that no one could listen to. If you have a comment about the show afterwards, if it's not positive, I can tell you now I will delete it. So thank you so very much for today. I appreciate it, Cheryl. Of course, keep sending those books coming because I know there's more. Everybody have a great day. The sun is shining. And
bye-bye.